Good afternoon and welcome. I'm glad to see that some people could turn up for this event. I realise it's the last week before the exams start, so it's obviously nice to have some people turn up, even though I'm sure you'll be getting ready for exams in the future. What I want to talk to you about today is this fairly broad-ranging title of Technology, Innovation and Life. And the idea of this presentation is not to be like a traditional computer science lecture. I am not going to talk about the latest computer technologies, the latest software, the latest APIs, those types of things. The idea of this presentation is more about making you think about what it is that you're going to do when you leave university. Because ultimately, you are the people who are going to be creating the next eBay, the next Microsoft, the next Google. You are going to be the people having the next big ideas. I want to kind of help you figure out what those ideas are going to be and where they're going to come from. So like I say, it's a fairly wide-ranging title and we'll go into some interesting things there. And again, this is not going to be like a traditional computer science lecture because it is going to involve some audience participation. I know that normally fills most people's hearts with dread about audience participation. But don't worry, it's not going to be terribly arduous. Now, I've divided this presentation into three parts, and I'm not going to be giving any prizes for guessing what the other two parts are going to be. Like I say, this is not traditional in terms of computer science. We're going to start with some history. But I think it's very important to look at some history, because it gives us some ideas about how we've got to the point where we are at the moment and how we're going to see things change in the future. So I'd like to start off with this diagram, which kind of gives an idea of how technology has changed through time. And it's a pretty broad approach to the way technology has changed. And I base this to some extent on a book that I read, or at least part of a book I read, by Bruce Sterling. Bruce Sterling's a science fiction author, also writes a lot of articles about technology and trends and things like that. And he came up with a way of classifying the way that technology had changed, which I thought was quite useful. If you go back, way back in history, a few thousand years, what you find is that man has always been technological. He's always used tools, he's always used things to help him in his everyday life. But in terms of creating things, back then, everything that was created, everything that was made, had to be made by hand. Which meant that everything you had, whether it was a new pair of shoes, whether it was a new pot, whether it was a new wheel for your cart, anything like that, had to be made by hand, and you had to find somebody with the right skills who could take the time to manufacture that thing for you and find the raw materials for it as well. The effect of that meant that it was very expensive. In terms of the economy, it was very expensive to basically make anything. Things were very precious in terms of objects. Now that carried on, and we really talk about it, sort of people who use these things as hunters and farmers. And there was a big switch when we moved from the idea of gathering food to producing food. Now if you zoom forward in time to about the 15th century, around the sort of 1400s, we saw a big change start to take place in terms of technology. We entered the age of what we call machines, where things like the printing press were invented in Europe. Things like the spinning jenny, things like the weaving machine. The fact that you could then use a machine to create objects for you. You weren't having to do it all by hand. Now that was a big improvement, but it still wasn't something which would allow us to produce things on a huge scale. We had to wait another 300 years for the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the steam engine, the capability of using a machine to drive the machines that were producing things. And that was, again, really big shift in our whole society and the way we use technology. Again, zooming forward in time, if you look at the beginning of the 20th century, sort of the 1920s, we started to see another big shift in the way technology was used. And this was really about the age of mass production, the idea of people being consumers of goods, and rather than things being produced by machines in limited numbers, what we started to see was the mass production of components, which were then assembled on a production line. Things like the Model T Ford, first car to be produced on a production line. That allowed us to really churn things out and produce goods at a much higher rate, which meant the cost went down. So we had the age of consumers. Again, looking into like the last 30 years or so, 30 or 40 years, we see entering the age of what we call gizmos. And this is really about shifting from objects which have a fixed ability. Now, your washing machine can only do one thing, it washes your clothes. The cooker that you have only does one thing, it cooks food for you. But about 40 years ago, we started to see objects coming around which could be reprogrammed. You could change what that object did simply by changing the instructions that it had to operate. The invention of the IBM PC, the invention of the mobile phone that could be reprogrammed with different functions, MP3 players, all sorts of different objects nowadays can be reprogrammed to make them do different things after you've bought them. So we entered the age of the end user. And really looking to the future, which is what I'm going to cover later on, Bruce Sterling came up with this classification which he called spines. And this is things which are part of our network, but not in a traditional IP address type of way. And we'll explore some of the ideas about what those things might be as we go on. So, let's look at a very common everyday object and how technology has affected that object through time. Now, sort of very brief history of one, something which is close to my heart, and I'm sure some of the people in the audience as well. Wine production goes back many thousands of years, literally to about 5000 BC is when you can first see the production of wine. And the storage of wine started off in clay pots. Like I say, manufactured by hand, manufactured one at a time. About 300 AD, the Romans came up with the idea of putting wine in glass bottles. And from then on, it was about another 1400 years before anything significant changed in terms of wine technology from the point of view of the bottle. About the 1700s, along came a French monk, a guy by the name of Dom Pérignon. And he figured out that by putting a cork in the top of the bottle, he could actually stop the wine from going off for longer. And he also invented champagne, as a kind of side note. But that was really the biggest change in terms of the wine bottle until about 30 years ago. And there are three significant changes that have happened to our bottle of wine in the last 30 years, very much related to technology. I want you to think about what those three changes are. Because I have here a bottle of wine. And I will give this bottle of wine to somebody in the audience if you can come up with, well, at least two of those things that have changed in terms of the bottle of wine. And it has nothing to do with the glass that's being used for that bottle. It has nothing to do with the wine inside it. Two of those things are very relevant to information technology, to courses that people are studying. So I want you to think about what those changes might be. And we'll come back to this, give you a couple of minutes to think about it. So the next thing we need to do is, while you're thinking about that, let's think about information. Because information is something which we have far more access to nowadays than we have ever had access to before. And there are some very interesting statistics around information. So for example, I've got here a copy of the Times that I bought on my way up here today. Now that newspaper contains about 250 articles on things covering all the world. If you read the Times newspaper from cover to cover, and you did that for a week, you would actually be exposed to more information in that 1 week of reading the newspaper than your average person in the 15th century would have been exposed to in their entire lifetime. That's how much information we have access to now. And, you know, to give you a few more statistics, because I like kind of finding these sort of statistics, there's an estimate which is that there's more information we've generated in the last year than in the preceding 5,000 years. There's an estimate that the average middle-sized business generates more information in a year than the whole of mankind did in the years 0 to 1500. Now, this is the kind of thing that we're dealing with. Another thing which, in terms of information, I find really interesting. Here in the UK, we have some very old universities. And Oxford, Cambridge are two of the oldest universities. Cambridge University, very interesting university. In 1424, they actually published a list of all of the books that they had in their library. How many books do you think they had in their library in 1424? Any ideas?
Ten.
Well, actually, you know, you're not far off. It was 122. That was how many books they had in their library in 1424. And 50 years later, they published another list. They had 330 books in their library. Each one of those books was probably worth about the same as a farm in terms of that time of history. This was because books had to be copied by hand up until the invention of the printing press. So the availability was very restricted. So why am I talking about all this? It's the fact that we have access to lots and lots of information. The internet, huge amounts of data, all of this information available to us. What's the point of that? Why do we need lots of information? Information is only really useful if you can increase the amount of value from that information. And you need to be able to measure things using that information. Think about, you know, monitoring lighting, air conditioning, water usage, all the different things that we have in our lives. The more that you can measure those types of things, the more you can control how those things are used. So if you can increase the control of those things, and the fine-grained control of those things, then you can improve efficiency. If you can improve efficiency, you can reduce the costs associated with those things. The cost of electricity, the cost of clean water, all of those types of things. You can reduce the cost, you can increase the value. Ultimately, what that leads to is an increased quality of life. This is what we've seen over the whole of human history, is that by being able to control things more, we've been able to get greater efficiency, reduce the costs, and so on. So let's come back to our bottle of wine. Like I say, there are three things that have changed in this bottle of wine. So does anyone want to take a guess at what those things are? Any one of those three things. One of these things happened about 30 years ago. One of them happened about 8 years ago. And one of them probably about 8-9 years ago. So anybody got any ideas?
Plastic corks.
Plastic corks. Well, yes, that's true. But in this case, I'm going to give you that one. It's actually a screw top. Yeah. So this is the thing which is not really related to information technology. But it's significant because it means that now you have to have a machine to put that screw top onto the bottle. So it has to be manufactured by a machine rather than having somebody putting in cork by hand. Very difficult to put a screw top on and have it sealed and do it by hand. So there are two things, information technology related, which are different about this bottle of wine. Anybody got any ideas? I'm glad you said the cork, because I put these slides together in a particular order, and most people get them in the same order that I put the slides together. So, any ideas?
The description written on the bottle?
That probably has changed, but in terms of the information contained in there, there probably hasn't been any difference in terms of the description that's put on that bottle. But you're kind of close there.
Barcode.
Barcode, very good. That's good because you got the second one in the order that I wanted it. Now, this is very significant because now our bottle of wine becomes machine identifiable. When we go to the supermarket and we buy this bottle of wine, I can pass it, well, the person in the checkout can pass it in front of a barcode reader. A laser scans that barcode and gets a number associated with that bottle of wine. That number can be used to look up information in a database and get back the information about the price, the description, printed on the receipt, but also can be used to track how many bottles of that wine are being sold and how much is in the store. So that you can keep track of that information, you can measure things, and you can improve efficiency. Because you know when you need to order more wine. You don't run out of that particular type of wine. Therefore, people are happier because they can buy what they want when they want. So that's very significant, the fact that it is machine readable. So there is one more thing that has changed, probably in the last between five and 10 years, I would say. And most people find this quite hard to get. If nobody else gets this, I'm going to give you one. So one more thing that's on that's related to this bottle of wine. Any ideas? Okay. Well, all right then, I'm going to give you the bottle of wine. The answer is, it has a web address printed on it. This is very significant because now our bottle of wine is not just machine identifiable, but it also carries with it a huge amount of information. We're not restricted to just that small piece of paper that's printed and stuck on the bottle of wine. We now have access to a website where we can see photographs of the vineyard, where the wine was grown. We can see information about the production process. We can see other wines from it. We can see reviews, recommendations. Huge amounts of information are available to us as a user of this bottle of wine. And that's the kind of thing that's very important. That's what I want to get across, is the changes that technology have affected in terms of an everyday object. So we now have a bottle of wine that is much more interesting in terms of the information.
But isn't it the case, because no one thought of that web address, that obviously we're not using it, so it's potentially accessible?
Possibly, but it's also maybe that we're so used to everything having a web address associated with it, we don't even think about it anymore. It's sort of ingrained now as part of our everyday life. I mean, you think of all the different places where you see web addresses, and you just, you know, you kind of, it's just the same as having a postal address or, you know, that kind of thing. So it may be that that's one of the reasons, is that we're just so used to seeing web addresses on things that we just take it for granted now. So let's look at the way that industry has changed and get into more of the ideas of innovation. Electricity is something that's been around for a long time, and it's a very good example of how industries change over time. They typically go through three phases of development. The first is when the technology is new, and when electricity was first invented, first became available, anybody who wanted to use electricity needed a custom solution. They needed to have somebody build them a generator, put it in the basement of their school or their block of flats or their university or wherever, and have that electricity connected so that they could run the things they wanted to run on electricity. Obviously that meant that the solution they had was very expensive. Custom solution, built one-off, very expensive. And it meant that not many people had that. Now as time goes by, more and more people want electricity. The providing of that electricity becomes something where we now have the idea of, let's put power stations outside of the cities, let's run cables to the cities and wire up the buildings in the way that we have the national grid at the moment. In order to do that, we need to have standardization. We need to say that the electricity we're supplying is going to be the same in all buildings. Because if you want to supply something like a kettle or a television or something like that, you need to know that it runs on a particular type of electricity. Because otherwise you end up with a television for Coventry, a television for Sheffield, a television for London, and that's very expensive. So you need to have standardization, and we have 240 volts, we have 50 hertz, we have 13 amps, we have 3-pin plugs with square pins. So we've got a nice standard, we know that we can plug in, and we use that kind of electricity. So that's where you get standardization, aggregation, going towards a well-defined platform. Ultimately, what that leads to is a utility model where the providers of electricity are all basically the same. The only thing that differentiates one provider from another is the cost of that electricity. I mean, if an electricity company comes to you and says, we have better electricity than somebody else, you're going to go, how is it better? You know, it's still 240 volts, 13 amps. Okay, now you can argue that they produce it in a greener way, But in terms of the electricity itself, you can't really say, well, we have better quality electricity than somebody else. So you end up with a utility model. Now, the same thing's happening in IT. Go back 50 years or so, and you would see that the beginning of IT was a custom solution. You needed a mainframe computer, which would be built for you by typically IBM, and would be installed in your data center, and would be very much a one-off solution with one-off hardware, one-off software, and very expensive. That meant that there weren't many of them. Clearly, as time has gone by, we've seen more and more computers being used. Thomas Watson is misquoted as having said that, you know, he thought the market for computers worldwide was about 5. Clearly, that's wrong. He actually didn't say that, but it's an interesting quote that people come up with. So there are lots of computers, and we're seeing now standardization. Typically, people using computers are going to have something like an Intel processor, an AMD processor. If we're lucky, they'll have a Spark processor. You know, there are a couple of other types of variations, you know, PowerPC, things like that. Operating system-wise, again, we're seeing standardization, aggregation. Windows, very popular. Mac, very popular. Spark, hopefully very popular. Linux, very popular. So a small number of choices of platform. And Java is an interesting thing because it gives standardization across all of those things. The whole idea of write once, run anywhere. You take the same application, doesn't matter whether you're running on Linux, whether on Windows, whether on Solaris. The same application runs across all the platforms. So we're seeing standardization of our computing platform. And we're seeing a move towards a utility model. The whole idea of grid computing, or as it's being called now, cloud computing. Things like Amazon are providing their Elastic Compute Cloud, which is a great marketing term. It's like, what does that mean? Other than it's a hosting service. But it's this idea of, rather than you having the processing power on your machine, you generating your own electricity, why not say, okay, let's access the compute power somewhere else on the network and draw whatever computing power I need and pay only for what I need. So that's good. If we want to avoid this thing where we're going to only differentiate ourselves on price, then we have to innovate. We have to come up with new ideas about how to use technology, how to use IT. And that's really the key thing here, is innovation is going to enable you to provide better value, better services. So what we're saying at the moment is that the information age is history. We're at the end of what we describe as the information age. We're now entering into what we call the participation age. Things are changing again. So the second part of my presentation is clearly going to be about where we're at the moment, the present. The first thing I want to talk about here is a thing called the long tail. Who's heard the term the long tail? Okay, a couple of people, that's fine. I mean, it's not a particularly widespread term, but it's very interesting. Now, I've got a picture of two books here. The first of these is called Touching the Void. And this is a book by a climber called Joe Simpson. It's a story about an expedition he and a friend made in the Andes. And they went to the Andes, they climbed a mountain, and they run into some severe problems. And the book is basically their story about survival, getting down off the mountain. That was published probably in the early 90s, and it sold a reasonable number of copies. People who liked climbing books bought the book and enjoyed it. I read it, I enjoyed it. In 1996, there were a number of expeditions to Everest. There always are around the end of May, in fact, this time of year. And that year, big storm came in, a lot of people were hurt, a lot of problems, people coming down off the mountain. So John Krakauer wrote a book about the expeditions on Everest that year. And it's a story about people surviving coming down off the mountain. That became a bestseller. It became a bestseller in both the US and the UK. Top 10, both countries. Now, Touching the Void had almost gone out of print at this point. And suddenly, it started to sell more books. And it's gone on to sell more books than Into Thin Air. It now outsells that book about 2-1. Why? Why would a book that's almost out of print suddenly become a bestseller, even though it was printed and sold several years before? Any ideas?
They recently made a film of it.
Now, you see, a lot of people come up with that. They recently made a film of it. Actually, the film was made after the book became a bestseller. So suddenly the sales went up and people thought, oh, we'll make a film of that. The answer is Amazon.com. Now, who's bought a book from Amazon.com? Okay, everybody wants. When you go to Amazon.com and you look for a particular book, you get details back about that book. But that's not all you get, is it? You get people who bought this book also bought this book. You get recommendations from other people that have written reviews of a particular book. They take all that information and they present it to you when you're looking for a particular book. So this is why Touching the Void suddenly became a much better seller, because people were going to Amazon.com and they were looking for Into Thin Air, and they were finding that there were recommendations for Touching the Void. And because it was a story about a similar kind of thing, people were buying it, seeing reviews and so on, and suddenly sales took off. And this is really the key behind the long tail. If you go into your typical big bookshop, you'll find they have about 130,000 books, different books, in their shop. Amazon.com, over half of their sales come from books which are outside of the top 130,000 books. That's the significance, is because when you deal with things online, when you're able to sell things online, you're not restricted in the same way that you are with a normal shop. You know, CD shops are the same. If you go to a CD shop, they have a number of CDs on the shelves. Each of those CDs has to sell 2 copies a year to make it worthwhile putting the CD on the shelf. Now, okay, most people now don't buy CDs, but the thing is that we're shifting to an online way of doing business. People like iTunes, people like Rhapsody, they don't have the same overheads associated with putting things on a shelf. They have a server that serves up the MP3 files. They can put as many titles as they like on there, and the cost of including a new title is almost nothing. The cost of putting it on a disc, the cost of maintaining that disc is, you know, negligible. So what we're talking about here is this graph. You have sales versus popularity. And typically, if you go into a shop, what you're going to be seeing is the most popular items. Bookshop, CD shop, that type of thing. You're only going to see the most popular items. And it's a kind of chicken and egg thing. Most popular things sell in the shop, they become the most popular things. So it's very difficult for things which are not popular to become popular. Online shopping means that you can sell less of more, because you can sell things that are way, way off the popularity kind of scale. And you can sell those things and still make money out of it. So this is the idea of the long tail. Web 2.0. Who's heard the term Web 2.0? Yeah, most people. It's a very common thing at the moment. You know, there are lots of websites that are described as Web 2.0. There's, you know, Flickr, there's YouTube, there's MySpace, Facebook, all of these social networking types of websites. These are all considered to be Web 2.0. It's about people adding information, not just pulling information down. Rather than having somebody just put up a website and put the information on there, it's about contributing data as well as taking it away, putting photos up, putting videos up, putting personal information up, all of those types of things. So let's look at a few of these sites. eBay, interesting thing. Who here has bought something through eBay? Okay, most people here. Let me ask that question again. Who here has bought something from eBay? No. Nobody's ever bought something from eBay, have they? Because you buy things through eBay. There's somebody else that's selling the goods to you. eBay provides the facilities. They provide the auction infrastructure, or the, you know, buy now type infrastructure. But it's a way of actually enabling you to go and find items that people have for sale. And this is the same kind of idea as the long tail. It's enabling you to access a far wider audience. Because if you set up a shop, or, you know, you clear out your loft, How are you going to sell those things to people? You could, okay, put them outside your house and have a sign saying, you know, yard sale or whatever. And only a few people are going to walk past and see what you've got for sale. If you put them in a shop, you're only going to get the people in the local area coming past that shop, small number of people. eBay allows you to access the entire planet. Over a billion people who are on the internet can access eBay. And so they can look at the things that you have for sale. That gives you a much wider audience, and therefore gives you a much better chance of selling the things you're trying to sell. So in terms of its popularity, eBay is really quite phenomenal. If you add up all of the transactions that went through eBay, and in fact the last time I did this it was for 2006, I haven't done 2007 yet. 2006, add up all of the transactions that went through eBay, and you compare it with the GDP of all the countries in the world, eBay is actually the 60th biggest country in the world. It's actually shifting the economics of the global economy because people are clearing out their lofts and enabling you to sell goods in a different way. So this is really significant in terms of the way that we interact and the way that we do business over the internet. Another good example, Google. Now, it would be stupid of me to ask you if you've used Google, because everybody here has used Google. It's just, well, it's something that we're so used to. Google is not just a noun anymore. It's now a verb. You know, you Google something, you Google somebody, you find out information that way. But here's an interesting question. Who here has ever paid to search on Google? No. So nobody ever pays. You know, you go to google.co.uk, you type in the search terms, you get back information. You don't have to pay for that service. Google are phenomenally successful. They have billions of dollars in the bank. They make billions of dollars every quarter. How do they do that if they don't charge for their search service? The answer is?
Advertisements.
Advertisements, exactly. What they're doing is they're changing the way they do business, or they have changed the way that they do business, in effect. Because they're not charging directly for the service, they are providing another service which goes into that. So every time you search, you know, you see the sponsored links, don't you? Down the side you see sponsored links, or you see the highlighted ones at the top. Which, when you search on a particular term, like you might be looking for, I don't know, parts or, you know, details of a particular version of an Audi, then you're going to get adverts for people who service Audis, people who sell spare parts for Audis, those types of things. And that's how they make money, because they can target very, very precisely the kind of people who are looking for particular information. And that really is a very, very efficient way of marketing things to people, because you're only aiming your adverts at people who have some kind of interest in the terms that you're specifying. And you can specify whatever terms you like. And in fact, the pricing of those things changes depending on what you're actually allowing people to search for. There are people in America, there are lawyers in America who will actually pay a couple of $100 for each time somebody searches on a particular term. Now that might seem like an extremely large amount of money, but it's in very specific terms. It'll be something like, I broke my leg, I want to sue someone. And they'll put up their advert in front of you for that. Typically, it's more like about, you know, 20, 30 pence for each time that somebody pops up your advert in front of them. But it's a great way of showing that there is a different way of doing business without selling directly, using technology, using innovation to find a way of generating an income. Where do you get information? Blogs. Who here has a blog? Anybody? No. At least one person. Good. Somebody's got a blog. Blogs are another way of sharing information. It's about participation. People blog, they share the things that they're working on, they share their information about what they're doing in their lives. A lot of this can be very, very boring, but a lot of it can be very, very useful. At some, we're encouraged to blog about what we're working on, so that we can share information about the things that we do at some. Our engineers share information through their blogs about what they're doing in terms of development, about what they're doing in terms of helping customers, which gives a great source of information that can be searched through Google when you have a problem, You know, if something doesn't work quite the way you want it to, you can search, Google will find information in blogs, bring it back, and you can see more detail about how to solve a particular problem. So blogs are changing the way that we deal with traditional media. We're moving away from just the idea of printed newspapers, television news, and getting information directly from blogs. Wikis, or Wikipedia to be specific. Who's used Wikipedia? Yeah. Who's actually written an article for Wikipedia? Good. Several people have. That's what I always like to see. That's the important thing, because lots of people are contributing information to Wikipedia. You can get articles about all sorts of different things, weird and wonderful things, and it's a great source of information. It's not just like the Encyclopedia Britannica, which covers the sort of standard, you know, biology, chemistry, you know, history, geography, all of those sort of standard subjects. You go to Wikipedia and you can search on, you know, any term you like, and you'll find that there's all sorts of different information. You know, for example, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and we were trying to figure out how many episodes of Lost there were left to be broadcast. And so, type it into Wikipedia, boom, up pops the list of episodes for Lost Season 4. That's the kind of thing you can get information on, because people are uploading that information as well as downloading it. Ajax, asynchronous JavaScript and XML. This is the idea of how to make the interaction with a website more like a desktop type of application. With the web browser, the way that it's been developed up until now, we've always dealt with the idea of request and response. So you type in a web address, and that sends a request through HTTP, brings back the HTML page, and displays it on the screen for you. If you click on a link, that then has to go back to the server, sends another request, brings back the new information. Ajax, which has actually been around for quite a while in terms of the underlying technology, is about doing it asynchronously. So if you go to Google Maps and you type in a postcode, what you get back is a map, which is a request response. But at the same time, what's happening in the background is that the web browser and the page itself, through JavaScript, understands that what you're typically going to want to do is to move that map from left to right, zoom in, zoom out, see more detail. Rather than waiting for you to do that and then bringing the information to you, it actually does it while you're looking at the map. That way, when you do move the map, the information's already there. And so it's much more interactive, it's much more immediate in its response. And so it looks like a typical desktop type of application rather than a typical web browser type of interaction. And that's the kind of thing that's very important. The other thing that's very important is the concept of mashups, and more specifically, what are called web services. If you look at all of the typical Web 2.0 sites, you know, Flickr, Facebook, Amazon, Google, all of these types of companies, they don't just provide a web address that you can go to and download a web page and interact through your web browser. They also provide this thing called a web service. A web service is a way of accessing their service from a program. And you do it using these things called SOAP and WSDL. There's several other acronyms that are surrounding this. Now, you can clearly see that we're making progress in terms of computer science because we're moving from three-letter acronyms to four-letter acronyms. But the idea is to enable you to access that service without knowing how it's implemented. So you're just using XML to ask it to give you some information. Whether it's using Java, whether it's using Microsoft, whether it's using whatever, doesn't matter. The interface is always the same. And you can take these web services, you can bring them together and combine them to make a new application. You can take videos, you can take pictures, you can take maps, you can overlay all this information and provide a new service based on the existing one. Again, the idea of Web 2.0. Now, participation doesn't just sort of involve adding information in terms of websites, pictures, videos, blogs, and so on. Participation is very much about open source software. Open source software has been around for probably the best part of 20 years. And it's really only the last 10 years, I'd say, this has started to have a significant impact on the whole software industry. Literally now, any software that you would pay money for, you can find an open source equivalent of that. An open source equivalent which is free. So if you want an operating system, you can have Linux, you can have OpenSolaris. If you want a word processor, you can use OpenOffice or StarOffice. If you want a browser, you can use Firefox. If you want an integrated development environment, you can use NetBeans, you can use Eclipse. All of these things are free. But in addition to that, you can get access to the source code, the instructions for how to make these applications work. And you can change them. So you can take the source code, you have a bright idea for how to improve it, you can rewrite part of the code, you can add things to it, and you can make it better. And you can do that in a completely free and easy way. Obviously, depending on what license it is used. But it enables you to access that code. Now, I do have to put a few some specific bits in here. And one of the things that I'd like to promote is the idea of Java open source projects. So we have a website called java.net. This is a great resource for people who want to either use open source Java software or create their own. So if you go to java.net, there's probably over 3,000 projects now, covering all manner of different things. There's gaming, there's robotics, there's enterprise software, there's all sorts of different things that you might want to use Java software for. And you can either download the code and use it for a project, you can get involved in a particular open source project, you can contribute ideas, you can do things like that, or you can just contribute ideas in terms of the documentation, anything you like, but it's all free. We're providing this to help people develop open source Java applications. So let's look a bit at the future and what we might see moving forward. Well, the first thing is going back to this idea of innovation. And like I say, talk a little bit about Sun and what we're doing in this sense, because innovation is absolutely critical to a company's success. If you simply go with the same ideas of shipping the same kind of products that everybody else does and everybody else uses, you're very much going to be in a utility market. You're very much going to be in a situation where the only thing that you can do is vary the price. And if you do that, you're not going to be in an area where you're going to make a lot of money. So, innovation, what are we doing? We're innovating in all different areas. One of the things we innovate in is hardware. We actually produce our own processors. So we produce the Spark processor. And often people say to me, why do you still do this? Why do you not just admit that everybody uses AMD, everybody uses Intel, and just use that? Well, because then that puts us in a utility model. We do have AMD processors. We do have Intel processors in our machines. But we think that there's a very big market for innovation in terms of processors. And one of our latest processors, the UltraSpark T2, is a very good example of this. Why? Now, because of the way that things work in terms of chip technology, it's getting harder and harder to drive up the clock speed of processors. So typically now what's happening is you're moving away from just cranking up the number of transistors, cranking up the clock speed, to going to the idea of having multiple cores in the same chip, effectively having multiple processing engines or CPUs in the same chip. So Intel have a dual core, they have a quad core. AMD, they're just coming out with quad core as well. In here, we have 8 cores. And the next one that we're working on will have 16 cores. That means you can do 8 things simultaneously with this chip. But in addition to that, we can run 8 threads per core, because we can actually interleave all of the instructions in the clock cycles and actually have 8 threads running simultaneously on the same core, which gives us 64 effective processors in the same physical chip. Why is that great? Well, because the chip itself only uses 95 watts of power. And if you divide that into 64, that works out less than 2 watts per effective processing unit. This is the kind of thing which is very, very important. Because if you go to the big banks, the big financial institutions, the biggest problem they have today is not about spending money on new hardware. It's about how to get hardware into their data centers and run power to it and run cooling from it. And that's the thing that they need to solve, because they just physically can't get enough electricity into the building to run and cool all of the processors. So by doing this, we mean that we can actually innovate and reduce the amount of power that's required for this type of thing. And it's very, very efficient for the idea of running web servers and web services and things like that. And it's open source. We actually provide all of the instructions for Spark. You can download all of the instructions. Should you have a very large fabrication plant and a few million dollars to spare, you can make your own Spark processors and not pay us any money. Now, I wouldn't expect a lot of people to do that, but there are companies who are doing that. Solaris. Again, people say, well, you know, why not just go down the Linux route? Why not just go down the Windows route? Because it puts us in a utility market. Solaris does have innovations. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into this, but there's things like ZFS, or as my American colleagues insist on pronouncing it, ZFS. And what that does is it changes the way the file system works. We now have a 128-bit file system, which means that you're never going to run out of addressing capability. You couldn't build a file system that's big enough to run out of addressing capability with ZFS. And it does various things which make it very, very efficient in terms of its throughput. It also does really interesting things through what's called copy-on-write, so that you never actually lose the data that you're modifying. And then you can create snapshots and instantly go back to them, all sorts of things like that, which, if I had more time, I'd explain to you in greater detail. But it's the kind of thing that gets our customers really excited when they're looking at storing data and maintaining backups and things like that. Dtrace is another really interesting piece of technology, because it allows us to instrument the kernel and applications in ways that you've never been able to do so before. You can literally ask a question through the Dtrace subsystem of any part of the system and figure out what's going on. And you can monitor, you know, which processes are using this and that and how they're interacting with the system. And if you've got performance problems, if you're working as a system administrator, that type of thing, this thing that makes your life significantly easier. And it's free, and it's open source. Java, you know, we're still innovating in Java, even after, was it 12, 13 years now? 13 years. And you know, there's lots of ideas for what's going to go into the next version of Java, Java SE 7. I mean, I've just put a slide up here which just lists a whole bunch of these things. But we're not saying that Java is done. There's still a lot of ideas around things like closures, to improve the language, to make it more easy to write applications, and so on. And talking a little bit more about Java, you know, this whole idea of write once, run anywhere, the standardization of our applications. But Java's not just a programming language, it's also a platform. You have the Java Virtual Machine, you have the Java language, and you have the Java class libraries. And Sun are very keen that we don't tell people what direction Java's going in. We want people to be involved. So we have this thing called the Java Community Process. All of the different parts of Java are specified through the Java specification requests. If it's mobile phones, you'll find people like Nokia, Sony Ericsson, Vodafone, T-Mobile, all of the companies who understand that market are working on defining what Java needs to do in that area. For enterprise systems, you'll find people like Oracle, you'll find people like IBM, you'll find people like Sun, all working on these specifications. In fact, pretty much every company that has an interest in this type of technology is represented in the Java Community Process. And again, it's open source. We've open sourced the Sun implementation of the Java Development Kit. So you can get access to that code. You can modify it under a GPL license. If you do modify it, you can't call it Java unless it passes the tests, but you can modify the code and create a new product from that. We're looking at how to use the virtual machine in new ways. Virtual machine's been very successful in terms of deployment. It's been very successful in terms of its security. It's been very successful in terms of its performance. You know, we've done a lot of work around garbage collection, around adaptive compilation and things like that. So how can we make it more useful to other people? And one of the ways we're looking at for doing that is running scripting languages, things like Ruby, things like Python, PHP, on top of the virtual machine. to give you this standardization, cross-platform functionality, not just for Java, but also for scripting languages. NetBeans, who uses NetBeans here? Somebody's got to use NetBeans, come on. Nobody? Who uses Eclipse? Okay, that's a little disappointing. I would have thought at least somebody would use NetBeans. NetBeans, you know, again, people say, just why don't you just like say that Eclipse is one and, you know, just join the Eclipse Foundation? Well, we actually believe that people should have a choice. You know, okay, everybody here uses Eclipse, but there are a lot of people out there using NetBeans. It's a very popular platform. And we think that by having more than one open source IDE, it fosters innovation, it fosters a kind of competition between the different organizations to see who can come up with the best platform, rather than just having one. And looking further into the future, this is a slide that I've used a lot in presentations. It's really about how the internet itself has changed and the way that we interact with it. You know, back in the very early days of the internet, sort of in the early 90s, even the late 80s, it was really all about transfer of files, connecting servers, connecting desktop machines through Ethernet, and making information available either through FTP or through things like SMTP for email. And that was really the kind of thing that we were using. Transfers of information at a network of computers, things that we would recognize as computers. We've seen that with the invention of the World Wide Web and the fact that people have access to the internet, things have changed and things are still changing. So the types of devices that connect to the internet, you know, mobile phones connect to the internet, games consoles connect to the internet, TV, set-top boxes connect to the internet, even cars can connect to the internet now. And so we're moving away from a network of computers to a network of things that embed computers, things that you wouldn't recognize straight away as a computer. The type of way we interact with that now, we use things like HTTP, we use SOAP, we use WSDL for web services, all of those types of things. Web applications, web services. And looking into the future, we're going to see more and more devices connected to the network, but not necessarily in the way that we see them connected at the moment. So rather than having a traditional IP address, they may have other ways of connecting to the network. Now, there are these laws of computing that people often quote. Moore's Law is the most fundamental of these, and Gordon Moore was the co-founder of Intel, also recognized as being the inventor of the microprocessor. He predicted back in 1965 that the number of transistors that you could squeeze into the same size piece of silicon would double roughly every 24 months. And he came back 5 years later and he said, I was wrong. It's actually going to be every 18 months that this number will double. And he'd been right. It has continued to double at that rate. And it will continue to double at that rate for a few years to come. I mean, there's still a few things we can do to squeeze more and more transistors into the same space. And I always like to actually show you this because I'm doing the time, not too well. Here's a good example of putting Moore's Law into context. This is the first calculator that, I didn't actually own this, my dad bought this. And it's a Sinclair, Cambridge. Anybody remember Clive Sinclair? Okay, so this was his company. He produced this calculator. This was back in about 1974, I think this came out. It has four functions: add, subtract, multiplication, division. That's all it does. Now, if you translate that into today's money, that would cost you £340. And I was showing this to my wife, and I said, look, you know, £340 for a four-function calculator. She said, why don't you just use your mobile phone? And it was like, well, yes, that's not the point I was trying to make. But it shows you the reality of Moore's Law in action. You know, nowadays, you couldn't even buy a calculator that has that few functions. Gilder's Law. Gilder was the inventor of Ethernet. And he predicted that network bandwidth capacity is going to triple every 12 months. You know, more and more fiber optic cable, more and more availability of network bandwidth. And we're seeing that change. We're seeing a movement towards much more broadband kind of interaction. It used to be that broadband speed was 512 megabytes, megabits per second. Nowadays, you know, I have, at home in London, I have a 20 megabit per second connection, which I always find it is kind of like magic to me. I can't believe that when I'm sitting in my desk at home, I can actually communicate with the internet at such a high speed, given that only a few years ago, my network in the office was only running at 10 megabits per second. And this kind of leads to Metcalfe's law, which is about the idea of your value of your network increases exponentially as you add more and more nodes. And it's the idea that the more possible connections you have between nodes, the more the value of your network goes up. And that's not just going up as the number of nodes increases. It's actually an exponential growth or a kind of n squared type of growth. RFID is an interesting way that devices are going to become part of the network. It replaces the barcode. It replaces the idea of having machine identification using a laser scanner. Using an RFID tag, which I've got here, you actually send a radio signal picked up by the antenna, which is the kind of coil around the outside. And it uses that energy to power the processor and then send back a signal telling the reader what the identity of this tag is. It contains 256 bits of information. Now, if you compare that to your average MP3 file or average AVI file, that's pretty small. But it's actually a lot of information. 256 bits. 56 bits of information, you could give a unique number to every grain of rice that was eaten last year. If you had 134 bits, you can give a unique number to every molecule on the surface of our planet. 256 bits means you can give a unique number to every single thing that you put one of these tags on. So now, when you go home and you take your shopping, you put it into the fridge, and the fridge has an RFID reader. It reads the tags on the shopping, and it goes to the internet and retrieves information about what you've just bought. That doesn't just include the price, the description of the item. It also can include information about when that item was produced. And that way, it can send you an email saying you need to buy more milk because your milk is going to go off tomorrow. That type of information. You can put your clothes into the washing machine. You don't have to set the controls. You just say, wash my clothes. It reads all the tags in your clothes and says, no, I won't wash your clothes. You go, why not? And he goes, there is a pink sock in with the whites. This is the kind of problem we can solve with RFID. Which leads us to wireless sensor networks. And this is really a kind of combination of three different things. One is computing power. And there's a corollary to Moore's law, which is called Meade's law. And Meade's law says that the price of a transistor will halve every 18 months. In the same way that you can squeeze twice as many onto the same piece of silicon, the actual cost of doing it halves at the same rate. So simple processors become cheaper. Sensors also benefit from the same manufacturing technologies as processors, so sensors become a lot cheaper. Communication, the available wireless network communication has become much more readily available. Everywhere now has Wi-Fi access. People have Bluetooth for many, many different things. You know, that's the kind of thing which is driving this idea of wireless sensor networks or smart dust. And this leads to a project which we've had some called Sunspots. And this is all about figuring out where we can put Java next. We've done cell phones, we've been very successful at mobile phone technology, desktops, things like that. What can we do in terms of smaller devices? So I have a thing here called a Sunspot, which is this little box here. And it's basically got an ARM processor in it, it's got 512 kilobytes of RAM, 4 megabytes of flash, which might not seem like a lot, but then remember we're not running Windows on this, so we don't need a lot of memory. It uses wireless communication, it has used 2.4 gigahertz frequency range, so it's the same as Wi-Fi, but it uses a thing called 802.15.4, a different protocol for sending information. It's what's called a personal area network, very similar to 802.15.1, which you also know as Bluetooth. So it's the idea of short range communication, low power communication. And you've got some sensors and things like that. I'll show you a demonstration of that in a moment. We're also looking at how to develop Java in different ways. So it has this thing called the Squawk virtual machine, which has been open sourced as well. This does not require an operating system. No Linux, no Solaris, no Windows. It runs Java directly on the processor. And we've really gone around saying, OK, let's try and write as much of the Java virtual machine in Java as possible. And we've used various techniques around translating it into native instructions and things like that to make it run efficiently on that platform. So just to summarize before I give you a couple of demonstrations, technology is an exciting place to be. There's lots of things which potentially, when you leave university, when you go out into industry, that you can use and make things more interesting. Innovation is what matters. You have to innovate to avoid the idea of being in a utility market. Thinking outside the box is very important. The idea of, you know, things like eBay, things like Google, where you're not charging directly for a particular thing, but you're finding other ways of generating revenue from the services you're providing. Open standards, open software. You know, this has to be the way to go. It has to be the most sensible solution. And, you know, hopefully, Sun is about open standards, open source. Hopefully, when you come up with the next big idea, you'll think about using Sun technology for that. So with that, one thing I would ask you to do is have a look at developers.sun.com. We have put up a lot of information there for students, for people interested in Java. It's free to join. We won't send lots of spam email to you. We will just send you a newsletter if you want that newsletter. There's all sorts of things you can download from there. And so I recommend having a look at that. So just to get... Oh, there we go. And that's about 40 lines of code. Most of the code there is actually the fonts that you need to get the LEDs to flash in the right sequence. But it's really very, very simple to program these things. And having done some embedded programming in my past career choices, it became such an incredible thing to actually work with these and figure out that you can actually just download your sort of the code onto it, and it just works. And you know, you can debug it, and it's really easy to program compared to other things that do similar kinds of things. So I'm just going to show you another example here, which is, again, using the accelerometer. And this time, what I've got is what we call a ball in a jar. So as I move the spot, it gives the idea that I've got a little ball which is trapped in my sunspot. So you might think, well, okay, that's very good, but so what? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn another one on. That one boots up, and hopefully that one comes online. Now you notice this one turned green. The reason this one turned green is they're now talking to each other wirelessly. So they've established a connection between the two, and they're now, they know that they're there. So again, so what? But what I can do now is I can actually open the jar on this side and open the jar on this side. And then when I tip this one, what you'll see is that the ball will actually move from one to the other, because they're communicating wirelessly and telling each other about what's going on, and the information is being passed back and forth, and then that one will join up, and then we've got that ball trapped back in that one. I'll just show you one more demo, which is one of the nice things about this is you can actually connect things to it. So I've got one here. This is a data glove, which has some bend sensors on the fingers. And so what I've done is I've wired up, there's some little connectors there that use an analog to digital input. And you can measure the amount of bend on the fingers. You can use the accelerometer, and there's also a gyroscope in this. So you can actually see when the glove's being moved. But the other nice thing is that not only can you connect other sensors and therefore read information from them, you can also connect other things in control. So what's called an actuator rather than a sensor. And what I've got here is my lovingly handcrafted robot. And I figure any computer science project that involves woodwork is pretty cool. So I built a little robot here. And all I've done is connected it up. So I've got two servo motors that I've modified so they rotate continuously. And literally all you have to do, as you can see, is there's just a few wires here that connect up the robot. And what I can do is I bring that one up and put that on the floor. And then focus on the other spot there. So I've got one here. I basically sort of tore the joystick out of a game controller, and I've wired that up to the spot as well. So I can use that one to control the robot. And then if I boot that one up, what that's going to do is it's going to read information from the joystick, and then as I move the joystick, it's going to send information to the other spot, and then hopefully it will drive the... There we go. Now, I wrote this application yesterday. I ran out of time. I was going to do some more kind of sophisticated things. I wanted to combine the tilt sensor and the accelerometer with it. But it gives you, this literally took me about an hour to write the application yesterday afternoon to control this. And it really is, it's very, very simple to build applications with these things. So hopefully this has given you some ideas about what we're doing in terms of innovation and technology. Now, I was going to give away a sunspot kit. Who would be interested in having a sunspot kit? Okay, because I was going to give one away. Probably what I'll do is I'll actually have to send it through the post. So, you raise your hand first. So if you give me your details afterwards, I'll send you a sunspot kit so that you can play with these things as well. So that's it. Thank you very much.